Mexico.
You idiot, Joram broke in. Suppose somebody spots these mules tonight. You've jumbled it, you lunkhead.
Leave them be, leave them be, Joe said, still perfectly calm. You can't tell one mule from another, not if you was the mother of one of them. Don't look a gift mule in the mouth, old son. I got 'em trimmed to a fare-thee-well, packs and everything.
Joram and the girl examined the appearance of the three with care, and at last pronounced that they would do.
Go back to the river, Joram commanded the muleteer, who believed in accepting the gifts of Providence. Work up the bank until you find the boys in the barge. Hang out with them. Have you got a gun?
Nothing but,
Joe said, indicating a rifle that was slung at his back.
Tonight is an exception to the rules. Shoot first and ask your questions afterward. Pass that word on to the boys, too.
They'll be sorry to hear it, but I'm not. So long, chief.
He turned on his heel and went off with a long stride.
Good man, Joram said, looking after him.
Too good for his job, Francesca commented with some irritation. You shouldn't use a general for a corporal's work. Joram, he's stolen those animals, and that may mean trouble for us all.
It's too late to cry about it, Joram said. Too good? Perhaps he is. It's time to start, Francesca. Isn't it about the right time?
It seemed odd to Weldon to see grown men, certainly with experience, deferring to a mere slip of a girl at a time of such apparent importance.
"We're almost half an hour later than we should be," she said. "Perhaps they've gone to bed by this time."
"Not on a night like this," Joram said. "Perfect night, Francesca."
"Perfect for them when they start hunting us," she snapped.
She swung into the saddle lightly, unassisted, and sat sidewise in it. Onto her hands she slipped a pair of castanets.
"Are you ready?"
Weldon and Joram mounted.
"You, Roger," she said to Cunningham, "you have a lone hand to play. Is that all right?"
"I suppose so," he answered, not too enthusiastically.
"Start about a half hour after we leave. Drive slowly down the street, and sound your horn a time or two to let us know that you're coming."
"I understand."
"When you come to the cafe, you know the place?"
"Yes."
"Be prepared for a good deal of life, Roger. We'll probably be making a running fight of it. You'd better have a gun on the seat beside you."
"Are you going to be in the gunfire?"
he asked her sharply. For answer, she snatched from her dress a glittering little nickel-plated revolver. It flashed in the moonlight, and she laughed as she put it away again.
"You fool!"
cried Cunningham.
"Today I brew, tomorrow I bake," she said,
and led the way toward the town.
Chapter 34 All positions that meant excitement and profit were agreeable to Benjamin Wilbur. Medicine could have contented him if, twice every day, he had had to perform an operation on which life or death depended. But since he could not reach that happy condition, and since, moreover, he was apt to be a trifle rash in his medical experiments, he had left that honorable profession and roamed the world as he found it. And much he found in it, to be sure. Yet never was he more perfectly at home than when he sat in the café of Miguel Cabrero in the town of San Trinidad. The café was not a money-maker like the gaming-house of Cabrero, but it was a substantial business, and even more to the mind of Cabrero than the risks of the gambling place. Good food, one always can afford to give one's patrons. Good luck, one cannot. He had a thread of the honest man in him, this Mexican. He and his brown, fat-faced wife loved the café, and did much to make it attractive. The inside room flared with reds and yellows and flashed with gilding. Pictures of lovely girls smiled or laughed from the walls, and big mirrors enabled the patrons to see their own contented faces. But the majority of the business, except in the few cold winter months, was done outdoors. The second story of the building projected well over the ground floor, supported on a row of arches. Within the arches, Cabrero had laid down a pavement of large red flags, and there he set out small round tables. Larger tables could be set out at mealtimes,
and always those tables were crowded. The food was good. The mezcal was excellent. The white brandy would have burned the throat of a tiger. There was fresh pulque for those who preferred that strange liquor, and Miguel had several brands of wine that tickled the palates of his customers on great occasions. On this night, the proprietor himself strolled among the tables as usual, bowing and smiling right and left. He was known to be rich. Therefore his bowing and smiling flattered everyone. The ladies smiled and grew pinker. The men swelled their chests and sat deeper in their chairs, full of importance, when the rich man passed. Cabrero understood exactly what passed in their minds, but he did not feel humiliated. He had, in fact, the instinct of a servant. He liked to see people happy, so long as it was putting money in his pocket. He would have made a good tyrant of the patriarchal type, or a good first minister of such a tyrant. He knew that he was a clever man. Now, as he walked among the tables of his café, he almost felt that he was an honest man, too. He was giving special care to the café in these days, because since the night that the fiend of an American had broken up one of his roulette wheels and torn the brake out of it, his gaming hall was not patronized so heavily. It was all very well for him to explain that the brake was never used, except against a dog of a gringo. It was well enough also to say that all the rest of his machines could be examined in turn, for he had made them honest for the moment. Nevertheless, the fact remained that he had been exposed. He had not been shamed, really. It would have taken a monstrous lot to shame Miguel Cabrero. But he had been checked. Now he gave his mind to the café, and waited for time to heal the wound that his gambling house had received. He checked the guests off on the tips of his mental fingers. The prosperous rancher received one sort of bow and word of greeting, the poorer but more constant visitor another. Cabrero knew exactly how much of himself he needed to give to each of his guests, until he came to Benjamin Wilbur, who, as usual, occupied the rear table in the corner of the arcade at the rear, watching everything with his keen eyes, and particularly watching the tall, powerful man who sat opposite him, his back to the crowd. That was Jim Dickinson, who was as a pocket of gold to Cabrero. Before long, he should turn it into current coin of Mexico. He could not help but halt and rub his hands together until they glowed. He leaned for an instant above that table. His face was fatherly as he glanced from one to another. 8 men in all. Dickinson, the guarded, Wilbur, the keen chief of the guard, and 6 good men and true, who were the body of the guard itself. He had a taste in scoundrels, had Cabrero, and these were hand-picked men culled from a long list of his acquaintances. There was not one of them that did not have at least a single murder to his credit. Most of them had more. They demanded high pay, but he was willing that they should have it. He hoped to squeeze from Jim Dickinson enough to refill his pockets and to make up even more than the blow that had been dealt to his gaming hall. So he beamed upon them, one by one, a caress in his eyes. And,
"You are comfortable, senor," he said to Dickinson.
That big man turned his lean face slowly toward his host.
"I couldn't be more happy, senor," he replied.
"And your dinner tonight?"
"That was perfect," Dickinson said. "Did your wife cook it?"
So bland was his smile that Cabrero almost let the thing slip by as a casual mistake. But then he flushed and bit his lip.
"Manners of an American," he began hotly.
Then he stopped. The cold, bright eye of Benjamin Wilbur was watching him, and the soul of Cabrero shook within him like a winter leaf on a twig.
"Go on," said Wilbur, smiling. "I won't hear you."
But Cabrero already had said enough. He turned his back on the table and went to the musicians, who were a little apart. They could make more noise than any other 4 musicians in the world. They could play a piece with more hysterical liveliness. They could play a piece with more drawling sentiment, In short, he was sure that they were the finest in the great Republic of Mexico. He called for a lively piece now. Lively music pays. It makes people talk faster. It makes them forget the state of their pocketbooks. It makes their drinks disappear more rapidly. A tall wheeled cart went by, spinning a dust cloud into the air from its revolving tires. The wind blew that dust into the cafe and spread it in a thin layer over the surface of every drink. But it was unregarded. Cabrero looked with anxious eyes. No one complained. People tapped on the tables in time with the stirring air, swallowed their drinks, and called for more. The panting waiters began to scurry here and there, and Cabrero smiled.
"A business needs the touch of the master's hand," he thought to himself.
The music died away. Down the street he heard the sound of a guitar and the faint rattle of castanets, and then the voice of a girl singing. Cabrero leaned a considerate ear in the direction of that song. No woman in San Trinidad could sing like that. It was not a strong voice, not a trained voice, but rich, and the song came off with a swing. Also, there was a foreign taste in the accent. From the south, no doubt. What women they had there! He worked his way to the front row of his tables. They extended out under the stars and blocked half the street and more. But the city did not mind. The chief officials were all his friends. When they stood before his bar, they knew that they did not have to pay. He never walked out there under the open heavens, in fact, without having the sense of his own powers brought more strongly home to him. He was a mastermind. He did what he would. Cabrero was full of complacence. Down the street a small crowd was approaching. It was recruiting every moment. Little boys and girls ran out from doorways and entered the throngs. Above their heads, Miguel Cabrero saw the ears of three mules. The procession came closer. It resolved itself into a girl who walked alone before the rest. She entered the fringe of the circle of light cast by Cabrero's big gasoline lamp. It fell on her sandaled feet. It glistened on her bare legs, twisted about by her sandal thongs. It touched her green earrings, the gilded beads around her throat, the red scarf that flowed down behind her shoulders or fluttered behind her as she walked. Light as the wind she came, still singing, and in the pauses of the song, making a dancing step or two, with the rhythmic jangling of the castanets. Cabrero knew dancing. This girl would fill his café every night of the year. She was a treasure. She drew still closer. The nearer she came, the higher rose the heart of Cabrero. She was very, very brown. But that only pleased him the more, because he liked the rich Indian blood. There was plenty of it rushing riotously in his own veins. In fact, she was a rose among women, and her great dark eyes were flooded with the joy of living. She stood before the café and sang the last verse of her song. Behind her stood the big, swarthy muleteer, holding the heads of the three mules. Closer to her was the guitar player. He was a Hercules, a great brute of a man. Those shoulders of his could have battered down a wall. His face was lowering, scowling. A shag of black hair, like the mane of a horse, poured over his eyes. A beast of a man. Something about his shoulders reminded Miguel Cabrero of another place, another scene, and a quiet-voiced American asking for money. Thousands of good dollars, honest dollars, from his safe. But he shrugged that thought away. He was not displeased by this monster. He made a perfect background, as a matter of fact, for the slender grace of the girl. Her song ended. Applause broke from the tables. Men were standing up and throwing coins, shouting, clapping. Cabrero was delighted, for he knew that pocketbooks are like hearts. Once opened, they never cease to pour forth. The muleteer left the mules to some admiring boys to hold, and went about on hands and knees, picking up coins with a feverish eagerness.
How base can men be,
thought Cabrero, thinking of his shining safe of steel and the treasure within it, thinking of his strong, clever brain, where still more treasure was buried.
Ah, life, world, how sweet it is to breathe and be!
But while the muleteer picked up the coins, the girl held up her hand. Cabrero saw a golden snake clasped about the round upper arm. The crowd fell silent at that commanding gesture. Then the guitar was struck. She began to dance, lightly and strongly, too. Nothing of that feathery smoothness that swims effortlessly through a maze of motions, but a power that struck off every high point. She whirled with spinning skirts. Her sandaled feet smote the ground as she stopped and whirled again. Her arms, her hands, her tilting head all swayed in the drunken joy of that dancing. She seemed to be dancing for no one but the god of dance. She seemed to be dancing for every leering pair of bright eyes in the café. In the middle of a bar, the music ended. The dancer stopped. She was panting hard, her lips parted, her eyes starry. There was no applause. The men were drinking up her beauty to the last drop in the glass. Then she leaned back and threw her arm around the neck of the burly brute, the guitar player. She kissed him. He merely scowled and shrugged her arm away. It was as though she had bestowed a caress on a surly lion, born to frown.
"Goddess! Goddess!"
Miguel Cabrero cried and struck his heart. The applause roared like rain. Like rain, the coins showered, glistening. They struck the ground. They struck the dancer's body. She stood still and laughed and held out her arms while the gold and the silver beat about her. Chapter 35 Benjamin Wilbur and James Dickinson were the only people in the café who were not overwhelmed with excitement. They sat like statues, looking at their excited companions, smiling faintly and critically at one another. They had been sympathetic from the instant that Wilbur took charge of the guard party. There was no malice felt by Dickinson because of the work that Wilbur had undertaken. Rather, he seemed to feel an especial kindliness for the other. They chatted familiarly, always. And yet, they never misunderstood. Each was ready to tear out the throat of the other at the slightest real provocation. They made an interesting contrast. Wilbur, more smooth, polished, talkative. Dickinson, huge, swift, and grim. But six men stood beside Wilbur. Therefore, Dickinson remained quietly in place, waiting as a tiger waits, with the patient ferocity of a cat.
"What is it?"
Dickinson said, as one disdaining to turn in his chair. "A singing, dancing girl," Wilbur said. "Greaser," he added carelessly. Dickinson poured himself another glass of beer. His eyes grew blank again. But then Wilbur was leaning forward.
"What is it?" Dickinson asked again.
"She's one in a million," Wilbur said critically. "I wish she'd come closer."
"She'll come closer to collect," Dickinson assured him.
In fact, the guitar began to be strummed again, not with any great art, but with powerful strokes that beat into the blood. The girl, singing, passed, weaving among the tables, her extended arms swaying through graceful gestures, the golden serpent flashing. Behind her walked the abysmal brute, glaring fiercely about him beneath his shag of tumbling hair. Behind him went the bulky fat man, holding out a hat, into which silver coins tinkled. Everyone gave. An excited vaquero caught the hand of the dancer and kissed it.
"They won't bother with us," said Wilbur. "They're going the other way."
"They leave the best for the last," Dickinson said, dry as always.
He would not give a glance. And Wilbur shook his head.
"You're missing something worthwhile," he said, "because she has the spark."
Dickinson yawned. Presently the singer came closer, pausing by the tables, bowing to generous donors. Someone had thrown flowers to her. She slipped a crimson blossom into the gray hair of an old, iron-faced rancher. The people laughed and shouted. It was becoming a festival. The sweetness and the passion of spring stirred again in their blood, and they leaned from their chairs to follow her with their eyes. She came again to the table where sat the two Americans, and there, as her song ended, she paused with arms lifted and stilled the applause. The guitar worked in muffled strings, humming an expectant air, and in the pause the girl swayed a little, like a bird on a wind-touched branch, a brilliant bird with music swelling in its throat, about to take wing and whirl and soar and dip in the glory of the sun. So she stood, poised, and full of the joy of motion to be. The guitar struck a piercing note. She swept into movement. Around the table of the guarded man she went. The guitar player took post behind the chair of Wilbur, stooping a little, murmuring with the words of the song. Even his brute nature seemed to be touched. He was excited in his turn, and a terrible excitement it was, for his eyes flashed through the fallen hair, as fireflies shine through brush. And then Wilbur heard a cautious voice saying at his ear, "Look straight before you. Don't turn. It's Lou Weldon, and we've come for Dickinson." Weldon. Dickinson. Never had Wilbur showed the strength of his nerves more perfectly than at this moment. He merely lifted the glass of beer to his lips. Then he began to wave a hand in time with the beat of the music. The Mexicans of the guard around him were open-mouthed, agape. They looked like starved creatures drinking nectar. They reeled in their chairs and swayed their heads. They looked at one another with mad, unseeing eyes. And again the voice at Wilbur's ear, "If you're with us, take up that glass and drink again. If you're against us, heaven help you." Wilbur closed his eyes. He liked to fight as well as any man in the world. But he thought, as he sat with closed eyes, of the brutal face of the guitar player, Weldon. Aye, and he could be brutal and terrible, too, as Wilbur very well knew. Then he opened his eyes and looked straight before him, and it happened by the surest chance that at that moment he saw Cabrero standing, with legs braced, eyes almost shut and twinkling with pleasure, and plump hands that were rubbing softly together. Wilbur raised the glass to his lips. Said the voice behind him, "Good boy, Ben. Now tell Dickinson, and if you can, pass him a gun." Wilbur pointed to the girl and leaned across the table, nodding to Dickinson. "Weldon is behind me," Wilbur said. "They've come to take you. I'll help. Reach under the table in a moment. I'm going to let a gun slide down my legs." He leaned far back in his chair, settled down in it, began to wave his hands again in rhythm with the dance. The girl had spun away among more distant tables, but the abysmal brute with the guitar remained where he was, behind Wilbur's chair, as though he expected that the dancer would return in that direction again. So, beating time with one hand, with the other Wilbur slipped out a gun and placed it on his lap. By depressing his knees, the heavy coat was made to slide down in the trough of his legs until he came to rest across his insteps. Dickinson coughed, dropped a box of matches with which he was about to light a cigarette, and stooped to pick it up again. He seemed to fumble at it twice, as a careless man will do. Then he straightened slowly. One hand fumbled at the matchbox. The other placed the gun in his own lap between his knees. There it could remain. An excited man now ran out of the crowd before the cafe. He approached Cabrero. He caught the arm of that gentleman. "What do you want?" the rich man asked, and struck the detaining, grimy hand away.
"Those three mules were stolen from my farm," the excited fellow said. "Those there in the street, I know them as well as my children."
"You are a fool," Cabrero cried.
What was the price of three mules compared with the good that this singing girl was doing for his cafe? He would have paid the bill out of his own pocket. Of course, they were three rogues. Only rogues wander through the country like that.
An accursed gringo was seen driving them off. I ran all day down the road. My heart broke. I was ruined if I lost them. Kind senor, help me to take them back.
Gringo, Cabrero said.
My little son saw him.
Your little son is a little fool.
But Cabrero began to stare at the three strangers. He looked at the dancing girl. Her accent when she sang was strange, not altogether of the south either. And yonder, he saw the brute of the shaggy hair leaning close to Wilbur, and his lips were moving. A hand of ice seized upon the heart of Cabrero. But he was in his own city, and heaven be praised for it, the kind heaven that watches over the thrifty and the sharp-witted. "When I drop the guitar, that's the signal," Weldon was saying. Wilbur leaned across the table. "When he drops his guitar, that's the signal," he repeated. And Cabrero saw Wilbur lean, saw him speak. For answer, Dickinson picked up a bottle of brandy and poured out a tumbler's worth. It was Mexican brandy, terrible as white fire. And here was enough to strike down a mule. But he filled the tumbler to the brim and raised it toward his lips. The Mexicans of the guard saw and pointed. They began to laugh hugely, their heads straining back in their mirth. Even this sullen American, this vast and terrible man, had been caught in the flames of the song and the dance, it seemed. They grinned at him with a sort of horrible fellowship. Cabrero turned to the door of his café. Two waiters stood there.
"Call them in from the inside," he ordered. "Get everybody! Guns, guns, knives, weapons! Move quickly, quickly!"
The pair vanished. They scurried like frightened rats to do as they were bidden. The dancer was turning back toward the table of the Americans and the armed guard. How Cabrero hated their gaping, mirth-ridden faces. Those practiced warriors, now helpless with the joy in the dance and the beauty of the girl. She seemed to Cabrero no longer beautiful. She was like the spirit of evil, plague in her touch, in her very presence. But now his men were coming. Praise heaven again, who gave to him such legions of the faithful. A sudden discord crashed on his ear. The guitar had fallen from the hands of the player, and in its place appeared the flash of two long revolvers, swiftly conjured into being like a terrible stroke of magic from a fairy tale.
"Treason!"
Cabrero shouted. The glass of brandy had been at the lips of Dickinson. Now he whipped it away with a gesture that flung the contents in a swift semicircle into the faces of four of the guard. The pale fire filled their eyes. They fell back from their chairs, yelling, clawing at weapons, blinded.
"Treason!"
shouted Cabrero again. The whole café was in a swirl. Through the street, jamming amid the crowd, came the long hood of a big gray automobile. Chapter 36 Four of that worthy guard had been incapacitated by a gesture and the devilish cunning of Dickinson. There remained two, however. A split second wiped the joy from their faces. Then, their courage returning, they brought out their guns. But fate stood behind them in the form of Weldon. The long barrel of a revolver dropped on the head of one, and he pitched forward onto the table. The second was clubbed across the back of the neck, and he swerved to the side with a single gasp and lay writhing on the floor. Like the vortex of a whirlpool, a gap appeared around that table, all dashing from the point of danger. And behind them went Weldon, rushing like a bull, splitting them apart like the point of a wedge. There were two shoulders to that wedge. One was Great Dickinson, silent, gun poised. He struck with it with cool precision, and trampled the fallen underfoot. The other was Joram, older, less springy of nerve and muscle, but now exerting a really great strength and nobly bearing up his share of the labor. In the cup behind this wedge followed the graceful dancer. Cabrero saw her go. She ran half-turned, and as hands reached at her, they shrank as from the touch of fire, for she carried a weapon also. It glittered like silver in her slender hand. So they split through the crowd and came to the automobile and were in it instantly. The girl sprang into the driver's seat and jammed the gear shift lever home in first. The engine roared. She sat erect in her place. And in the car were four armed men. The noses of their guns looked over the sides.
"Kill them!" shouted Cabrero. "Kill them! Tear them to pieces! Guns! Where are my men? I go mad! Help!"
His men were there, fighting through the crowd, keen enough for battle. But their path was littered with a crowd of struggling humanity. 100 armed hands ready, but all helpless with confusion. 2 calm riflemen could have stopped the car, shot the woman from her place, riddled the machine with bullets. But here were 100 shouting, shooting blindly. Men who had been knocked down cried out profanely as they were trampled. The cheerful café was a storm center from the inferno itself. And yonder the car moved down the street, and the crowd swayed out and around it again. The horn honked steadily. The guns roared. The car began to gather speed. Weldon sat beside Francesca, crouched a little, his armed hands ready, his head turned back. Only he gave her a glance now and again, curious in the midst of this battle, and saw that her lips were set hard and that her nostrils quivered a little. A very tigress, not a woman. A wild yell. They had bumped a slow-moving man into a wall from their path. He lay groaning, a bone broken, doubtless. They swerved to the left into a narrow lane as a bullet struck the front windshield and sent out the glass with a single crash. The confusion was ending. Hot pursuit was rushing after them. Weldon could hear the squealing of horses as they felt the spurs driven home. He heard the frightened yelling of women and children scattering from beneath the plunging hoofs. They shot about a corner of the lane, and before them arose a squat shadow, a hand cart squarely blocking the path. No time to back up from that alley into the street behind. The savage crowd would have them and tear them to pieces. No time to pause even and heave the cart to one side. She did not hesitate, this cool, erect, slender figure at the wheel. She thrust the lever into second and gave the car gas. So, like a living thing, it sprang forward and smote the cart. There was a screeching, a crashing, a groaning. The big machine staggered, swerved heavily to the right. They bumped with a second crash. An open door, caught by the right fender, was ripped neatly from its hinges. And then they were shooting through a chamber of blackness, a smooth flume of dark, with only the powder of the white stars scattered carelessly high above their heads. Suddenly the darkness opened in a wide, pale fan. They were through the town and in the open country. They were among the mesquite, dipping and swerving through it under the clever guidance of the girl. Ah, heart of steel! But still the pursuit had come swiftly behind them. Riders like shadowy spears flung themselves out from the streets of the town, firing as they came, and with a good aim. 12 times bullets hissed above them, or thudded against the rear of the machine. "It's all right," the girl said, calm as ever. "We have a sheet of steel down the back seat. This part of the game is over." With a purr like that of a contented cat, they slid over the sands, dipping easily in and out among the obstacles. It was like the weaving flight of a bird, so effortless and sure. She was an uncanny master at the wheel. Joram stood up in the rear.
"Cut to the left, semicircle. Bear in, then toward the point. You'll tell it by 2 big trees. That's the place I told them to take the barge."
She swung obediently to the left. The brush flew past. So they neared the river trees at last and safety. A lantern flashed before them.
"Halt!"
The command came in good American, a little through the nose. "Halt or I'll blow you to—" They darted past that light. A gun began to fire rapidly, and every bullet struck the rear of the machine. Only the steel plate was keeping those slugs from boring through the body from end to end.
"Border patrol,"
the girl said through her teeth.
"But this is Mexico."
"What's that to them?"
A pair of lights gleamed suddenly just before them, and between the lights stretched a glimmering chain.
"Halt!"
came a roaring chorus before them, and a pair of guns barked into the air in warning. Almost too late for that. She could not check the car before it struck that heavy chain, and to strike it would be to tip it over end for end and smash those within. So she jammed the brakes and swerved to the left. Sickeningly, the big automobile skidded. The brakes were off. The power was shut on again, and staggering between the two impulses, the machine lurched ahead. Dust had billowed before them, high and far. It seemed to shut the shouting voices away like a blanket of silence. Guns were barking, however, and hornet sounds thrust through the veil at them. Then before them, a spreading shadow. Mesquite, and they were lost. Creosote, and they might smash through. Creosote it was. Like a shadow it had risen. Like a shadow it was gone. And the big machine, heeling over with dizzy suddenness, sped away, exhaust opened, roaring triumphantly. Guns still clanged in a steady uproar. There must be a dozen men in that ambush, but now they were safely out of sight in the desert brush again, and they were whispering forward over the sands. The moon was high. Weldon could not help turning and looking behind at Dickinson, and he saw that he was comfortable in a corner of the seat, his hands folded in his lap, a smile on his lips. It was as though he had seen something in the distance, not as though he had been in the center of a typhoon. And for the first time in his life, cold awe of another mortal descended upon Weldon. Joram was on his feet again, clinging to the rear seat windshield.
"Francesca, you're a knockout! You're a wonder!" he cried. "All gold and a yard wide! Now head straight upstream. There's a second chance. If they've blocked us there, it's back into the Mexican mountains, and heaven help us!"
She nodded and gave the car more gas, so that the sand, upflung from the spinning wheels, rushed like water through a flume against the mudguards. The girl's confidence was amazing. They followed a long bend of the river to another knot of trees, and there from the bank they looked down on the comfortable bosom of a big barge. A shadow stood up in the moonlight.
"We're here, Charlie!" yelled Joram.
"Aye, aye!"
Another form joined Charlie. Down the bank they slid with grinding brakes, over the gangplank, and onto the barge. The motor was shut down to the faintest of whispers.
"Look the old car over," Francesca said to Weldon. "I think there may be a flat in the rear."
There was, flat and in ribbons. So while the noisy motor of the barge was started, the men jacked up the car and changed tires. When Weldon had finished the work and put the tools away, he found Dickinson standing beside the driver's seat. He was holding out his hand, and Francesca barely touched it.
"Thanks," she said, "but you'd better save that for Joram. I'm simply a hired hand."
The central current was forming around them now when she called,
"Joram!"
"Aye."
"Look down there. I thought I saw a pair of headlights for a second."
They all stared, and for an instant the lights gleamed again, though even in that brief moment it could be seen that they were rushing close at a great rate.
"Border Patrol again," said Francesca. "Thorough is their motto."
Chapter 37 Nerves that had gradually been relaxing were wire-drawn again at once. Automobiles were not casually driven over a roadless desert at such a rate of speed, and the flashing of the lights seemed to show that they were turned on in glimpses, only to illuminate some special difficulty of the path. The motor of the boat was now driven at full speed ahead. The barge tore loose from the central current and sagged swiftly in for the shoreline with unquenched effort. The result was a grinding crunch. The barge slid far up in safety, but with prow pointing upward at a sharp angle.
"Dumb,"
Francesca LaGuardia said, standing up at the wheel and looking at the result of this work.
"Dumb! Dash their stupidity," Joram said. "I'll hide them for this."
But the gangway was manned by everyone except the girl. It held down at a sharp angle, and before it was a high bank at what seemed to Weldon an impossible inclination for any automobile.
"You can't do it," he told her. "Why try to kill yourself? You never can get a car up that bank."
"Sooner that than prison,"
Francesca LaGuardia snapped, and she sent the car onto the gangway. The heavy boards sagged and groaned. Down dipped the gray monster, its hide ripped now and torn by the impact of many bullets, but its heart still pulsing and filled with vital energy. Taking full advantage of the downdrop, Francesca sent the engine humming with the clutch in second speed and hurled it at the bank, not straight up its face, but sideways at a slight angle. The spinning wheels cut and dug at the face of the bank, Still, the car skidded dangerously, swayed, gained the very top, and there staggered and toppled. Weldon closed his eyes. A sharp slap came on his shoulder. It was Wilbur.
"She's over," he said. "Wonderful girl, by George! Wonderful! Wonderful!"
They scrambled up the bank and piled helter-skelter into the car, Weldon again in the front seat beside that dauntless driver, while across the plain, through the brush, came the pursuer, if such it were. It had unhooded its lights now. Fiercely they flared through the brush, and a mighty searchlight, poised above, swung this way and that. They had heard the roar of Francesca's car. Now they were searching for it, like a hawk for quarry.
"One moment," Big Dickinson said. "I'll blacken their eyes for them."
He was seen standing, a rifle glued to his shoulder, and then he fired three times. The first time snuffed the searchlight. The next two put out the headlamps of the car.
"Now let him follow if he can," Dickinson said.
And follow he would, headlights or none. For as the car lunged ahead, soon screaming through second and dropping into the whine of third speed, behind them they saw the shadow of the other swerve to the side and follow like a flung javelin across the desert. Joram stood up in his place and leaned over the rear seat windshield.
"Seven men in that car, honey," he said to Francesca without excitement, "and she's holding us even. And it's the Border Patrol, my dear, as you may guess for yourself."
Weldon looked back in turn. It seemed impossible that any other machine in the world could be rivaling the rate at which they were traveling now, but certainly the monster to the rear was succeeding. A monster it was, even longer and lower than the gray beauty, and fully holding its own. Yes, gaining, little by little. Wilbur snatched up a rifle and began a steady dropping fire, until Weldon heard Joram say,
"It's no good, lad. I know that car. She's got a set of steel shutters in front, and she's got a bulletproof windshield. You can't dent her."
"Worse luck," Wilbur said, lowering the gun unwillingly.
"I know her like a book," Joram said,
calm as ever, but his big voice rolling up in spite of the rush of the engine.
100 horsepower, specially built. Goodness knows what she develops, but you can see for yourself, with 7 men aboard her. Duck, boys, they're opening up."
That was true. It was like the rattle of a machine gun, as at least 3 repeating rifles began to pour a dropping fire on the gray car from the distance. The car was shooting past the lower feet of Bull Mountain, with all the moonlit features of the landscape turned fluid and flying off behind them. Then Francesca dipped the gray machine into a narrow valley. The voice of Joram came again over their heads, a shout of excitement now.
"Francesca! Francesca, are you crazy? There's the ditch here ahead of us!"
She did not seem to hear. Her face was like steel. She sat erect, immobile, hands merely twitching up and down to meet the lurching of the front wheels as they tore through soft and hard in the sand. Sometimes the upflung pebbles whipped through the shattered windshield and stung the face of Weldon. They must sting her face, too, but she remained unperturbed.
"Francesca, do you hear?"
They were on a downgrade. Adjusting the mixture, she wrung an extra 10 miles an hour from the laboring motor. The air whistled past, tearing at their eyes, at their hair, with soft, strong hands.
"Francesca!" Joram yelled. "You'll smash us to a pulp! The ditch! The ditch! You fool! Weldon, for God's sake, take the wheel away from her!"
Weldon instinctively put his big hand on the wheel. She did not turn her head, but cried so that he could hear above the wind, above the motor.
"I know what I'm doing!"
He removed his hand.
"Sit down!" he shouted back to Joram. "She won't make a mistake!"
Joram collapsed onto the rear seat and covered his face with his hands. In the glance that saw him fall, Weldon saw more. He saw the pursuing car leap the crest of the rise behind them like a wild beast, and then lunge forward down the near slope, gaining, gaining fast. Nothing could keep them from overtaking their quarry, and, confident of the victory, they had ceased firing, though almost at a point-blank range. Under the silver white of the moon, he could make out the barrels of long rifles and the darkly masked face of the driver. Well did he deserve from his country for this headlong pursuit of which he was the soul. Then, looking ahead, Weldon saw a dark line drawn across their path. It widened instantly into a deep ditch. From the back seat, the voice of Joram shouted something. The ditch turned into a little chasm, with ragged sides of rock showing. Then they went at it with all the speed of the motor, with all the speed of that long, breathless drop down the hill. For the highest point of the nearest lip of the gorge, she aimed. Life or death in a breathing space now. Then they flung forward. The darkness was hurled behind them with a white flash of water at the bottom. They struck the sandy top of the farther bank with a shock and a crash that soaked the speed out of them in a moment, and then lunged slowly forward. Safe. Safe, unless that speeding demon behind them took the same chance. They looked back. The girl, throwing in the clutch, sent the car forward again. Ah, wonder of strength that wheels had held under that shock. And now they saw the long machine of the pursuit shooting straight down for the mark. As it came, Francesca, with the gray car sliding swiftly and smoothly over the sands, threw out the clutch and shut down the motor. Like a whisper they drifted. And then from behind came a wild cry from many throats, a terrible, ringing, tearing cry that Weldon knew would be lodged in his heart forever. He saw the big machine beyond the gorge stagger, then swerve, then spin rapidly around and around, lunge ahead, and come to a halt with his front part sagging. On the very lip of destruction, the driver had halted his car. Weldon looked back with a gasp of relief. Francesca lay buckled over the wheel, her arms hanging down. He drew home the emergency then and lifted her out of the car. Dickinson leaned above her and pressed his ear to her heart.
"I thought it had killed her. She went down when she heard that yell, as though it was a bullet through her. But it's only a faint."
"Take the wheel,"
Joram barked at Cunningham.
"Only a faint,"
he said, as they rearranged themselves in the car, Weldon in the rear, holding Francesca's limp body.
"Only a faint. I tell you it's the finish of her. She'll never be no good no more. She's burned herself out. Women are that way. They can last up to the burning point. That's all. A man, you can have him on fire 100 times, and he'll still come back. Her, she's through. She was worth 500,000 to me this morning. She ain't worth a cent over her carfare home now, wherever her home may be."
His anger was plainly manifest.
"There," Dickinson said with a grim smile, jerking his thumb at Weldon. "He'll be the junk receiver."
There was an utterly heartless scorn and amusement in those words that Weldon did not comprehend at first. Then he realized slowly, as a man realizes any prodigy, that here was what the world produces not once in a century. A man without a soul. He did not look at Dickinson. He did not even feel anger against him. He felt as one who looks over the side of a ship and sees the white horror of a cuttlefish rise to the surface and sink again. Chapter 38. She recovered almost as quickly as she had been struck down. She turned her face to Weldon and clung to him.
"They were all killed," she exclaimed wildly.
"Not one. Not one," Weldon said. "All safe. You hear me? Not one hurt. They stopped their car on the edge of the rock, the front wheels dipping, but safe. Do you hear, Francesca?" He had to say it over and over. She was like one whose brain has been dimmed with ether, gradually fumbling back to understanding and clear mind.
"Not one?"
She could understand at last. "All saved." Still, she clung for a moment. He felt the shudder of relief that ran through her.
"I'm well enough now," she said,
and slipped from his arms into the seat between him and Dickinson, who looked straight before him, smiling a little, his face blackened by the shadow of the moon. Nothing but disdain for this softness, this weakness, was in his expression. The girl looked up to him only once, and then shrank closer to Weldon. Joram was right, he felt. She had thrown her soul into that one great adventure, and the heart in her was burned out. The demon in her, might he not say? All that remained might be true, womanly, and gentle. and the very soul of Weldon took wing at the thought. Yet he fought back all sense of surety. One could not tell. On the journey out, she had surrendered to exhaustion and slept beside him like a child. And after that, she had been a spring of steel on which all the venture depended, and which had supported them all through terrible peril. She might recuperate again. There was something in her, at least, that 1,000 years of study never could explain to Joram or any of his kind. So perhaps she would once more be a bird of prey, all wings and cruel talons and beak, to soar and strike and live a man's life in a man's world. In the hands of Cunningham, the car was a different thing. It had lost throbbing power and dizzy speed, it seemed. Softly and gently it pulsed across the sands, swerved up through the hills, and there was the house of Joram again. Joram himself took Francesca into the house. He talked to her like a father. She was to go to bed and sleep. She was not to move from the place. He would take care of her, himself. To this she said nothing. The other cars were gone. The place was silent and dull, and the white moon shone over all, revealing its tawdriness in every bitter detail. So Weldon went to the room where he had left his clothes. He had hot water brought in. Slowly and painfully he removed the dye from his body, dressed, and went out into the hall. Joram, Dickinson, and Cunningham sat with Wilbur in the little front room, drinking whiskey from large tumblers as though it were water. None of them spoke a word.
"Where is she?" asked Weldon.
"What room?"
"The outside room," Dickinson answered, and he grinned, his evil grin of too much knowledge.
"What room is that?" asked Weldon.
"She is gone," Joram said gently. "Come in here, Lou, and share the split. Cunningham is paid up. You get your whack."
He took from his pocket a stack of bills.
"You wonder where Jim carried this?" Joram smiled. "He didn't carry it. He's paid me in something else. I pay you in cash. It was 50,000 for this job, son. 30% for overhead. Cut the rest four ways. That gives you nothing," Weldon said briefly. "I'm not in the game. I want to know where she's gone."
He came to the edge of the table. He waited. With a gesture, palm up, Joram said,
"I don't know, Lou. I'd tell you if I did. She goes her own way. She is never with us, except for business. You'll find a bunk in the back room. Turn in and sleep, old son, and in the morning you can change your mind about the split of the coin."
"I'll walk back," Weldon said. "I want to leave a message with you, for her."
"You'll never see her again," Dickinson said to no one in particular.
Weldon turned on him with a sudden fury.
"Do you know her?"
he asked savagely.
"Do you?"
Dickinson sneered.
"Yes.
Like fun you do," said Dickinson.
Weldon tapped the other on the shoulder. That shoulder was ridged with rubber-hard muscle.
"I don't like the way you say it," he said.
"There ain't much about me that you do like," Dickinson said. "You don't like my face, for instance?"
"I don't," Weldon agreed, and waited.
"Look here," Joram said. "Don't talk like that. Wilbur, take Weldon off. Dickinson."
Dickinson remained at ease, lounging in his chair, amused as he looked Weldon up and down.
"What do you want?" he asked. "Hands? Guns? Knives?"
"Anything that you ask for," Weldon said. "On foot or horseback, day or night, gun or knife, or bare hands. I don't like you, Dickinson. And if you take her name in your mouth again, do you know what I will do? I'll throttle you where you sit."
"I won't have you," began Joram, but Dickinson cut him off coolly. "I'm not that kind of a fool, Joram," he said. "I thought you worked with real men. I see that you have to fall back on this."
Total disgust and contempt were in his voice as he indicated Weldon.
"I'll attend to you in due time," he said.
Weldon turned on his heel and left the room. Only at the door he paused and turned back again for an instant. They all were watching him, curiously keen of eye. Then he went on down the hall. Nature had given him a soft step and a keen ear, and as he neared the front door of the little shack, he heard Wilbur saying quietly to the others, "Some of us grow old, some of us grow young. Weldon, for instance."
"Yes," Dickinson's hard voice said, "he'll hang in his swaddling clothes one of these days."
Then Weldon went out under the open sky. He was glad of the great space, none too large for him to breathe in. And with a long, swift stride, he went over the hill and toward the O'Malley house in the far distance. It would not be long until the dawn would come. Coming to the last of the taller hills, for he was cutting straight across on a beeline, as nearly as he could plot his course, he now became aware of a small house in a hollow. The house of the doctor, no doubt. It seemed odd that he never had been there before. It seemed odd that the little house should be sleeping there under the white of the moon, its front patterned in black by the trailing of climbing vines. So he felt lived the good old doctor, placid and gentle and true to all that was best in life, in the midst of the turmoil and the intrigues and the bloodshed that was sweeping across these mountains and turning the border red. He found that the house lay not far from his course, and therefore he dipped a little to the right and came up before it. Its very face, even at night, spoke of the good man within. All was trim, well clipped, and the whole place breathed forth peace. And so it was that Weldon stood for a long moment, staring, and wondering to himself if, in time, he could school himself until in his nature there would be found some shadow of the virtues that appeared so bright in Henry Watts. With strength, with patience, with endless love, he might in that manner redeem even wild Francesca LaGuardia, and— He turned away, as if to shut that sad thought from his mind, and turning, he saw the trail of wheels leading to the doctor's garage, which was a shed attached to his house. The doctor's car. He could remember it. The little old man sitting bunched at the wheel, holding its course as well as he could with uncertain hands. All that he did was fumbling and vague, like his large, mild, dim eyes, and Weldon smiled, his heart growing soft. He paused at the side of the tracks again. Large tracks for so small a car they were. And many a time the doctor must have run it back and forth in the same line to where the trenches in the sand so deep. Odd, too, that he should have been so accurate. Here, in one spot, a streak of darkness showed where the water from the watering of the climbing vines that clothed all the place and trailed fingers across the windows had seeped into one of the ruts. Weldon leaned over it and saw in the wet of the sand, faintly illumined by the moon, the pattern of great, oversized tires whose new tread had marked the place. The doctor's car? 10 of his cars, side by side, hardly could have made such an impression in the ground. And Weldon stood still, desperately combing his wits and arriving at no conclusion. He went to the door of the garage. It was fastened tight. He went to the window. It was covered with thick dust, like white milk beneath the moon. But that he rubbed aside, and so made a peephole through which he could look, and the moon with him. Then he saw the doctor's car indeed, and beside it, long and low, and apparently unmarred by all its labor, the great gray car in which Francesca LaGuardia had driven and dared so much that night of nights. He leaned against the edge of the wall, his breath gone, his wits whirling. All seemed a great machine, and all the wheels were interlocking and grinding together, but what that machine was accomplishing, Weldon could not guess. Francesca, the doctor, Dickinson, Joram, the O'Malley house, poor Helen O'Malley. What could it all mean?
Chapter 39 Dawn began as he neared the O'Malley house. There was a wintry cold in the air, and a sharp breeze driving the cold through him. He was glad of that.